Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We're growing gray hairs left and right, all of us, and we don't even know what we're going to do. We don't even have a plan.
Alaska's biggest homeless shelter is closing, and many using it don't know where they'll go next. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 14th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Fairbanks finally begins demolition on a dilapidated downtown high-rise.
It's sad to see what's happened to it, but it's nice to see a new start.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
An ash cloud that has drifted from a Russian volcano to Alaska disrupted air travel across the state for a third day in a row. Alaska Airlines had canceled 82 flights as of 3 p.m. today, bringing total cancellations for the airline to over 130 since Thursday, according to an airline spokesperson. The cancellations have impacted flights to and from Alaska and within the state, as well as to and from Spokane and British Columbia airports. The airline also warned that more cancellations are possible. They're specifically monitoring the location and movement of the ash cloud over southeast Alaska. The National Weather Service's aviation warning includes parts of that region. Nathan Eckstein is a science and operations officer at the Volcanic Ash Advisory Center in Anchorage and says the cloud is hanging over the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific Ocean.
So we have kind of a complicated system because this volcanic cloud is wrapped into a low that's south of the Gulf of Alaska. Some parts of it have gone into British Columbia and the Yukon and Western Canada.
The cloud is made up of sulfur dioxide gas and some ash. Eckstein says they're analyzing images to see how the cloud is breaking up and where the pieces may move next.
The ash is not going to stay suspended forever. It's going to fall out. It's going to get rained out if it's underneath clouds that are precipitating.
Eckstein says that any ash in the cloud will likely disperse in the next few days. Scammers stole nearly $1.2 million from an Alaska couple in an elaborate scheme that emptied their retirement savings and turned it into cryptocurrency. That's according to a court filing related to the federal government's seizure of cryptocurrencies from accounts that the scammers allegedly used. The civil forfeiture documents filed Thursday do not name the scammers or the victims, who are both in their 90s. But the court papers do lay out what federal authorities say happened. In June 2022, one of the victims was using a computer when a message claiming to be from the Microsoft Corporation appeared on the screen. It said the computer had been compromised and gave a phone number to call. On the other end of the line, the scammers posed as representatives of Microsoft and the investment firm Morgan Stanley. The scammers told the victims they needed to transfer their retirement savings into what they were told was a government account. At the scammers' direction, the victims made transfers to a bank in California and converted the funds to cryptocurrency. The scammers then transferred the cryptocurrencies between other accounts in a series of moves that a federal attorney described in the court filing as a, quote, money laundering pipeline. FBI agents have seized funds from 5 of the accounts, but because the exchange rates for the various cryptocurrencies fluctuate, it's unclear how much of the stolen money it represents. The assistant U.S. attorney assigned to the case did not return an email today seeking comment. It also remains unclear, so far, if the case will result in criminal charges against the alleged scammers. Anchorage's homelessness experts expect the number of people sleeping outdoors to swell from about 300 now to as many as 800 as the city's 3 winter shelters close in just over 2 weeks. As city officials and service agencies figure out the next steps, uncertainty and stress are mounting among the hundreds of people headed back into the woods and the streets. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Walter Tikuin has been staying at the Sullivan Arena since October. The hockey arena turned into an emergency shelter at the beginning of the pandemic, closed last June, and then reopened as a cold weather emergency shelter last fall. Tikuin thinks it'll be more dangerous for everyone after it closes.
It's stressful. We're growing gray hairs left and right, all of us, and we don't even know what we're going to do. We don't even have a plan.
He says it can be chaotic at the Sullivan. It's a low-barrier shelter, meaning being intoxicated or having a criminal record aren't disqualifiers. But he prefers it to sleeping outside on his own.
That's our only option right now.
He's one of about 460 people staying in the Sullivan Arena, the biggest of Anchorage's three winter shelters. Another 140 people are staying in hotel rooms contracted for winter shelter use. They're all set to close at the end of the month. Most people will have to start camping outside as Anchorage assembly members and service agencies plot what's next. They say they're working overtime and talking about increasing outreach and other shelter options, but time is short and it's not clear yet what new resources will be in place come May 1st.
We may have a couple weeks of chaos.
Assembly member Daniel Voland represents North Anchorage, where the Sullivan and many other resources are located for people without homes. He's repeatedly pressed to close the Sullivan. Its neighbors attribute graffiti, littering, pedestrians in the road, trespassing, open drug use, assaults, and even outdoor deaths to people drawn to the shelter. Voland thinks the shelter has to shut down for the rest of Anchorage to take part in managing homelessness.
I think Anchorage as a whole is going to be better here as we engage in this conversation and get some solutions online and are willing to think outside of the box.
Instead of a mass shelter, he says multiple smaller sites around the city would be better for the clients and for neighborhoods. Here he is at Tuesday's assembly meeting.
For so long, we've been fixated on the Sullivan. One more month, just one more month, just three more months, just six more months, just another year. How long is this going to draw out? So now's the time. Now's the time for a reset, and it's going to be hard.
Assembly members say they don't want another version of last summer's haphazard mass relocation of Sullivan Shelter residents to a dangerous campground. Their attention is split, but one quick change will be to increase summer outreach, and they'll vote on that soon. More outreach means meeting people where they are, including if it's in a tent in the woods, with food, medical care, hygiene services, caseworkers, and help with transportation. They say there may be some last-minute opportunities to lease some rooms for the most vulnerable. There's a new push to pilot a 30-unit tiny home village at some point this summer, and two former hotels are in the process of being converted to low-income housing. Assembly also wants to stand up a new, low-barrier shelter by next winter so that the Sullivan Arena doesn't reopen as a mass shelter for a fourth year. All that work may be too late for the immediate reality of shelters closing. Everyone's situation is different. For some people, the conditions at the Sullivan were already more discouraging than the cold. They chose to sleep outside. Alfred Kunaloak has done both, but spent this winter at the Sullivan. Even though he uses a wheelchair, he lost a leg in a train accident years ago, he's surprisingly at ease about what's next. He hopes he can get housing for people with disabilities.
If I don't get housing, that's okay. You know, at least I'm still alive and making it throughout the winter. Man, I've been sleeping outside for years, you know. I just had to be in here because it was a very harsh, very, very difficult winter last year, and it got way below zero.
Kunaloak says he's grateful that he was able to stay in the Sullivan. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, live-action role players or LARPers gather in Ketchikan.
It's all about having fun and connecting with the people around you.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A Superior Court judge in Bethel has dismissed a lawsuit accusing state officials of unconstitutionally mismanaging Yukon River and Kuskokwim River salmon fisheries, leading to a crisis on those rivers. The Alaska Beacon reports that Judge Nathaniel Peters, an appointee of Governor Bill Walker, said in a 16-page ruling on Thursday that plaintiff Eric Forer failed to identify any specific policy or action on the part of the Board of Fisheries or Commissioner of Fish and Game that could in any way be viewed as a violation of what is known as the sustained yield principle. That principle requires the state to manage its resources sustainably, and Forer had argued that salmon declines in western and interior Alaska were evidence that the state was failing to meet its constitutional obligation. Peters further concluded that Forer, a Juneau resident, was asking the courts to direct the management of fisheries. Forer's attorney said he planned to appeal. Once a center of activity in downtown Fairbanks, the Polaris building has been abandoned and decaying for over 20 years, and city officials and residents gathered Wednesday to mark the beginning of the end of the 11-story high-rise. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
City of Fairbanks Mayor David Prus welcomed people outside the iconic downtown structure.
We're gathered here today to honor and say goodbye to a lofty piece of Fairbanks history.
Mayor Prus shared some highlights of that history, which started in 1952 when the Polaris opened, providing 144 apartments and a lot more over the following decades.
There were several restaurants, bars, public and private offices, meeting space, a radio transmitter, a TV transmitter, and designated cold or fallout shelter in the basement, along with many stores all located within the building. There's even a private detective office. It was a hub of the Fairbanks community, activities, social life of the 50s through the 70s.
The top floor of the city's tallest building was home to the Petroleum Club and later the Tiki Cove, a popular restaurant Fairbanks resident Karen Perdue remembers fondly.
You could see the whole community from that restaurant. And when we were kids and we went there, it was a very special occasion. So it's sad to see what's happened to it, but it's nice to see a new start.
The Polaris building experienced a gradual decline in the post-pipeline construction era. It was repurposed as a hotel, but in 2001, a water leak and flood led to the building's abandonment and later condemnation.
What was once a shining star of downtown Fairbanks became an eyesore.
Mayor Prus leads a group that raised funds for the city to purchase the Polaris and worked with Senator Lisa Murkowski to secure $10 million from the Environmental Protection Agency to demolish it. Prus credited all levels of government with realizing the project.
The city of Fairbanks, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the state of Alaska, and the United States federal government.
The first phase of demolition is poised to get underway, and Sue Sprinkle, a city council and downtown association member who has long been involved in the Polaris project, celebrated the impending milestone like the launch of a ship. Local officials and members of the public followed by swinging gold-painted sledgehammers at the concrete facade of the Polaris Building Annex. There were also short tours inside the annex, a one-story Polaris Building addition that will come down before the main tower. City engineer Bob Pristash says an annex demolition contract was signed Tuesday.
And so to me, it's going to be hopefully like next week, but they got to do abatement inside before they actually demo the building. So the excavator won't be here next week, but, you know, it's going to be happening soon.
As for demo of the main tower, Mayor Prus says the city plans to issue an RFP in June to secure a contractor.
And put a plan in place to start demolition of the tower in late September. We don't want to interrupt the business of the tourism of downtown Fairbanks. So it's a 3 to 4 month project, so hopefully by around the first of the year, we'll have it done.
The Polaris Tower's concrete is contaminated with PCBs and will have to be shipped to a special landfill in the lower 48, an added cost Prus is seeking funding for. Looking beyond demolition, Sprinkle and Prus say the city is committed to seeing the site redeveloped.
All I know is that it should be multi-use, and it shouldn't be a parking lot.
We're not stopping until something nice is here. What that is, time will tell.
In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Juneau's housing crunch usually worsens in the spring as seasonal workers make their way to town. But this year, one of the people who works to house families said the situation is just plain scary. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has this story.
Dave Ringel works with St. Vincent de Paul, helping families and seniors find housing.
Every time we house somebody, somebody else comes on our radar.
He got an email from a fisherman from the Lower 48 who planned to bring his large family to Juneau for the summer while he fished. But Ringel knows how hard it will be to find housing for a family, and he's worried he won't be able to help.
I don't want to see people like that come up here and become homeless, and I wish I had a better answer for people.
St. Vincent de Paul housed 16 families in the last year, and they're working with around six more right now. By many metrics, Juneau's housing issues are getting worse. State data shows that in the first week of February last year, there were about 270 people experiencing homelessness in Juneau. In the same week this year, that number is around 330. Ringel said there are housing projects and programs in the works that will alleviate the strain on the community, but those projects take a lot of time.
It's a short-term emergency with few answers, and yet long-term, we're at a point where as a community, we cannot be healthy without a larger supply of housing.
Some people who do have housing are facing eviction due to large amounts of back pay rent from the pandemic-era eviction moratorium. St. Vincent de Paul helps with rental assistance, but their funds have been spread thin.
We ran out of the money that was used for that because it was going out almost 50% faster than it had any other year.
While the evictions open up rentals that Ringel can move other people into, the people being evicted then face the same issues. He said often people end up on the streets while looking for another place.
And I'm just hoping we keep people safe through the summer.
In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit rain.org. That's rain.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
In the Kobuk 440 sled dog race, most of the attention is paid to the top three finishers, but this year one musher stood out as the fan favorite along the trail. Rookie Jessie Downey spent part of her childhood in the Northwest Arctic and was the only Inupiaq woman in the race. In fact, she might be just the second Inupiaq female musher in the race's more than 30-year history. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen talked with the Willow-based musher about her Kobuk run and what's next.
This was 23-year-old Jessie Downey's first Kobuk 440, and she says it was the longest and most difficult race she has ever competed in. She says the heavy snowpack along the course was a challenge.
And there were some harder spots, like solid, but the base was softer. It's like walking in mashed potatoes or trying to run in mashed potatoes.
Along with veteran musher Michelle Phillips, Downey was one of two women in this year's 440-mile race, which starts in Kotzebue and carves its route through six villages before looping back to the Northwest Arctic community. Race organizer Paul Hansen thinks Downey may be just the second female Inupiaq musher in the race's more than 30-year history. Hansen says the last Inupiaq musher, Kotzebue-based Lucy Nordlum, ran the course over three decades ago. Downey says she thought about the connection to her culture along the trail.
People have traveled by dog team for a long, long, long time between these villages and just all around the region, and it felt pretty special to be able to continue doing that.
Downey also got to visit a place she grew up in the region just before the race start. Her father, Wesley Downey, is Inupiaq from Noatak, a village of nearly 600 people about 50 miles north of Kotzebue. Her Anna was Emmeline Downey and grandfather Mickey. Downey's family left the village when she was six. She says she received a warm welcome returning to No Attack by Dog Sled after an almost two-decade absence.
I felt like the whole town was out and everyone made signs, and they had just only found out I was coming up that day. And everyone was out hooting and hollering, and it was like I had just won a race or something.
She says it was also her first time visiting the 6 Northwest Arctic communities along the Kobuk 440 course.
Pulling into every village was a lot of fun. Everyone was so nice. They learned my name, Jesse Downey, and they're like, oh, are you from No Attack? Or, oh, my mom was cousins with your Anna. And so I'm like, oh, cool, we're family.
Downey first got into mushing while living in Willow. She loves it now, but at first was a little reluctant. It all started when an elderly neighbor asked for help caring for her dog team. Downey says her mother gave her a gentle push to assist the aging musher.
She kind of voluntold me, but it was good.
Downey went from working with other mushers' dogs to acquiring her own dogs and establishing a kennel of her own. She started Amagvik Kennel in 2016. Amagvik means home in Inupiaq. This year, she ran the 440 with all of her own dogs, which Downey says is significant.
When people say, oh yeah, she drove her own team, I put like all my time with them, helping them learn how to run and figuring out which ones can lead. And it was just me and the dogs.
Unlike many of the more established mushers in the Kobuk 440 who rely in part on sponsors to fund their kennels, Downey says besides support from friends and family, she has funded her kennel and races herself. She says she spent the past 5 years, from late May until early November, loading lead and zinc ore onto ships at the Red Dog Port. The port is part of the Red Dog Mine, a lead and zinc mine about 80 miles north of Kotzebue.
I can fund the kennel almost the whole winter. It gets a little slim at the end, but we make it.
Downey and her 9 dogs crossed the Kobuk 440 finish line in 9th place after about 4 days and 2 hours on the trail. She says she definitely wants to return for another Kobuk 440, but isn't sure if it will be next season. After completing the race, she is now qualified for longer distance competitions like the Iditarod. This year, her boyfriend, Hunter Keefe, placed 11th in the Iditarod, and Downey says her goal is to run the Iditarod next year alongside him and other friends. According to a representative from the Iditarod, if Downey competes, she would be just the 3rd Inupiaq woman to run the 1,000-mile course in the race's 50-year history. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Dressing up in armor and fighting with foam weapons might seem like child's play, but for some Ketchikan residents, getting together to roleplay is much more. KRBD's Eric Stone spent a rainy Saturday at Ward Lake with members of a group known as Iron Sky.
Alexander Kilgore is a barbarian, at least for today. Most of the time, Alexander goes by Paul Robbins Jr. When he's not wearing deerskin armor, a kilt with his family tartan, and streaks of black face paint, he's a public affairs officer for the U.S. Forest Service and a member of Ketchikan's school board. But today, he's Iron Sky's champion.
We come together and fight medieval-style combat and battle games, and it's a lot of fun. Our weapons are made of PVC and foam for safety, but other than that, we fight in medieval-style combat with armor and swords and all that.
And although it's pouring rain and the wind is whipping, today's games are a go.
We're going to make sure people are somewhat comfortable here. We've got a fire going. We've got shelters. We're going to make sure they stay inside until it's time for them to get out and compete, but we're sure as hell not canceling it. If you canceled for rain in Ketchikan, we'd never get out here.
You might have heard of role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons, where players create characters, go on adventures, slaying monsters, chasing ancient artifacts, and so on. And this is similar, but no game boards and no dice. Everyone's got a specialty known as a class. As a barbarian, Alexander is an attack machine. His strikes break through armor, and even after he's killed, he can run around for 7 seconds wreaking havoc. But before we get to today's battle game, there are 5 events celebrating Scottish and Celtic culture, starting with the caber toss.
All right, before we start the caber toss, who needs a rundown of how the cabers toss?
The objective is to throw a long, heavy, traditionally wooden pole in such a way that it flips end over end. Today's caber is a little less traditional than you might find in the Scottish Highlands. This one is made of aluminum pipe and foam and adorned with brightly colored tape.
You're going to get yourself a few running steps, however far you want to go. Once you have momentum, you're going to shove with your shoulder that caber forward and launch it. You want that caber to land and turn over. If it doesn't fully turn over to the other side, it doesn't count for points.
It's harder than it sounds. I mean, it takes a few rounds to crown a winner. But eventually...
Oh, that's definitely some points.
That could be a 10.
That's so close to a
10. Oh!
Alexander's son, 15-year-old Eidos Kilgore, is the big winner in the caber toss. He usually goes by Jameson Robbins. He says the events help him feel in touch with his roots.
My family is sort of two sides of the spectrum. I'm Scottish and I'm Mexican. So I'm learning Spanish to be with my mom's side, Spanish side, and then I do this to feel with my Scottish side.
Beyond the caber toss, there are some track and field events like the hammer toss and the shot put, and there are some more medieval and fantasy-focused events like the healer's race, where competitors race through a healing spell, and there's also the Irish charge or the dizzy izzy. Participants spin five times around a longsword and then attempt to run in a straight line and take a swing at a waiting victim. Not a bad way to spend a Saturday, says Eidos.
It's all about having fun and connecting with the people around you and building a large story with each other and just being with people and also not trying to take it too seriously.
That's something I hear from a lot of people. It's a welcoming, friendly environment. I find Beb's hack aiming his Nikon at the field as folks run through the events.
I think a very important part about LARPing is it's a fun way of, you know, exhausting yourself, finding a outlet of, like, you know, getting all that rambunctious energy out of you. And so, like, we go out here to smack each other with pool noodles. It is so cool.
Carly Hurst is somewhat new to the group. Today is her first day going by her fantasy name, Kira. She's an archer, and it's easy to tell. She carries a roughly 5-foot-tall longbow and a quiver of foam-tipped arrows.
And I grew up doing archery. I was like an 8th grade cosplaying Katniss Everdeen. So I just eat up anything archery, and there's not a range here, so I haven't really gotten to shooting because getting a target up here, a lot of places won't even ship them. So hearing about this, I was like, well, you know, moving target for free, let's go.
And now it's time for the highlight of today's gathering, the Battle Royal. Members pair off into 2-person teams, pick up their chosen weapons, and start wailing on one another.
My leg! I'm going to post!
It can look a little silly, swinging foam swords and feigning grave injuries, but Kira says, in a way, it's therapeutic.
I think it's easy for people to maybe see it as, like, juvenile, perhaps. And for me, like, methane has brought me to the present more than doing this.
It's a group with members of all ages, from toddlers to adults, all united by one idea. You can be anything you want to be. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Savon Crumry in Juneau, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.